Rum.
Why did you prefer rum?
I don't know, I just bought rum.
Was it to stimulate the body to a great extent?
No.
How much was bought?
A fifth of a gallon.
Who paid for it?
I did.
Did that money come from the treasury of the Communist Party?
No.
Don't they allow you a budget for recruiting expenses?
No.
How much was drunk before you bought the fifth of rum?
We had a few beers.
How many?
I don't know.
You don't remember much about what happened that night, do you?
I'm telling you all I remember.
All you remember?
Yes.
Is it possible that you don't remember some things?
I'm telling you all I remember.
Were you too drunk to remember everything that happened?
No.
You knew what you were doing?
Yes.
You deliberately left that girl in that condition?
She was in no condition.
Just how drunk was she after the beers and rum?
She seemed to know what she was doing.
Did you have any fears about her being able to defend herself?
No.
Did you care?
Of course I did.
You thought that whatever would happen would be all right?
I thought she was all right.
Just tell me, Mr. Erlone, how drunk was Miss Dalton?
Well, she was a little high, if you know what I mean.
Feeling good?
Yes, you could say that.
Receptive?
I don't know what you mean.
Were you satisfied when you left her?
What do you mean?
You had enjoyed her company.
Why, yes.
And after enjoying a woman like that, isn't there a letdown?
I don't know what you mean.
It was late, wasn't it, Mr. Erlone? You wanted to go home?
Yes.
You did not want to remain with her any longer?
No, I was tired.
So you left her to the Negro?
I left her in the car. I didn't leave her to anybody.
But the Negro was in the car.
Yes.
And she got in the front seat with him.
Yes.
And you did not try to stop her?
No.
And all three of you had been drinking?
Yes.
And you were satisfied to leave her like that, with a drunken Negro?
What do you mean?
You had no fear for her?
Why, no.
You felt that she, being drunk, would be as satisfied with anyone else as she had been with you?
No, no. Not that way. You're leading.
Just answer the questions. Had Miss Dalton, to your knowledge, ever had sex relations with a Negro before?
No.
Did you think that that would be as good a time as any for her to learn?
No. No.
Didn't you promise to contact the Negro to see if he was grateful enough to join the Communist Party?
I didn't say I'd contact him.
Didn't you tell him you'd contact him within 2 or 3 days?
No.
Mr. Erlone, are you sure you didn't say that?
Oh, yes. But it was not with the construction you are putting upon it.
Mr. Erlone, were you surprised when you heard of the death of Miss Dalton?
Yes. At first I was too stunned to believe it. I thought surely there was some mistake.
You hadn't expected that drunken Negro to go that far, had you?
I hadn't expected anything.
But you told that Negro to read those communist pamphlets, didn't you?
I gave them to him.
You told him to read them?
Yes.
But you didn't expect him to go so far as to rape and kill the girl?
I didn't expect anything in that direction at all.
That's all. Mr. Airlone.
Bigger watched Jan go back to his seat. He knew how Jan felt. He knew what the man had been trying to do in asking the questions. He was not the only object of hate here. What did the Reds want that made the coroner hate Jan so?
"Will Mr. Henry Dalton please come forward?" the coroner asked.
Bigger listened as Mr. Dalton told how the Dalton family always hired Negro boys as chauffeurs, especially when those Negro boys were handicapped by poverty, lack of education, misfortune, or bodily injury. Mr. Dalton said that this was to give them a chance to support their families and go to school. He told how Bigger had come to the house, how timid and frightened he had acted, and how moved and touched the family had been for him. He told how he had not thought that Bigger had had anything to do with the disappearance of Mary, and how he had told Britton not to question him. He then told of receiving the kidnap note, and of how shocked he had been when he was informed that Bigger had fled his home, thereby indicating his guilt. When the coroner's questioning was over, Bigger heard Max ask,
"May I direct a few questions?"
"Certainly. Go right ahead," the coroner said.
Max went forward and stood directly in front of Mr. Dalton.
"You are the president of the Dalton Real Estate Company, are you not?"
"Yes."
"Your company owns the building in which the Thomas family has lived for the past 3 years, does it not?"
"Well, no. My company owns the stock and a company that owns the house."
"I see. What is the name of that company?"
"The Southside Real Estate Company."
"Now, Mr. Dalton, the Thomas family paid you..."
"Not to me. They pay rent to the Southside Real Estate Company."
"You own the controlling stock in the Dalton Real Estate Company, don't you?"
"Why, yes."
"And that company in turn owns the stock that controls the Southside Real Estate Company, doesn't it?"
"Why, yes."
"I think I can say that the Thomas family pays rent to you."
"Indirectly, yes."
"Who formulates the policies of these two companies?"
"Why, I do."
"Why is it that you charge the Thomas family and other Negro families more rent for the same kind of houses than you charge whites?"
"I don't fix the rent scales," Mr. Dalton said.
"Who does?"
"Why, the law of supply and demand regulates the price of houses."
"Now, Mr. Dalton, it has been said that you donate millions of dollars to educate Negroes. Why is it that you exact an exorbitant rent of $8 per week from the Thomas family for one unventilated, rat-infested room in which 4 people eat and sleep?" The coroner leaped to his feet.
"I'll not tolerate your browbeating this witness. Have you no sense of decency? This man is one of the most respected men in this city, and your questions have no bearing."
"They do have a bearing," Max shouted. "You said we could question with latitude here. I'm trying to find the guilty person, too. Jan Airlone is not the only man who's influenced Bigger Thomas. There were many others before him. I have as much right to determine what effect their attitude has had upon his conduct as you had to determine what Jan Airlone's had."
"I'm willing to answer his questions if it will clear things up," Mr. Dalton said quietly.
"Thank you, Mr. Dalton. Now, tell me, why is it that you charge the Thomas family $8 per week for one room in a tenement?"
"Well, there's a housing shortage."
"All over Chicago?"
"No, just here on the South Side."
"You own houses in other sections of the city."
Yes. Then why don't you rent those houses to Negroes?
Well, I don't think they'd like to live any other place.
Who told you that?
Nobody.
You came to that conclusion yourself.
Why, yes.
Isn't it true you refuse to rent houses to Negroes if those houses are in other sections of the city?
Why, yes.
Why?
Well, it's an old custom. Do you think that custom is right?
I didn't make the custom, Mr. Dalton said. Do you think that custom is right? Max asked again.
Well, I think Negroes are happier when they're together.
Who told you that?
Why, nobody.
Aren't they more profitable when they're together?
I don't know what you mean.
Mr. Dalton, doesn't this policy of your company tend to keep Negroes on the South Side in one area?
Well, it works that way, but I didn't originate.
Mr. Dalton, you give millions to help Negroes. May I ask why you don't charge them less rent for fire traps and check that against your charity budget?
Well, to charge them less rent would be unethical.
Unethical?
Why, yes, I would be underselling my competitors.
Is there an agreement among realtors as to what Negroes should be charged for rent?
No, but there's a code of ethics in business.
So, the profits you take from the Thomas family in rents, you give back to them to ease the pain of their gouged lives and to salve the ache of your own conscience.
That's a distortion of fact, sir.
Mr. Dalton, why do you contribute money to Negro education?
I want to see them have a chance.
Have you ever employed any of the Negroes you helped to educate?
Why, no.
Mr. Dalton, do you think that the terrible conditions under which the Thomas family lived in one of your houses may in some way be related to the death of your daughter?
I don't know what you mean.
That's all, said Max. After Mr. Dalton left the stand, Peggy came. Then Britton, a host of doctors, reporters, and many policemen.
We will now hear from Bigger Thomas, the coroner called.
A wave of excited voices swept over the room. Bigger's fingers gripped the arms of the chair. Max's hand touched his shoulder. Bigger turned, and Max whispered, "Sit still." Max rose.
"Mr. Coroner?"
"Yes?"
"In the capacity of Bigger Thomas's lawyer, I'd like to state that he does not wish to testify here."
"His testimony would help to clear up any doubt as to the cause of the death of the deceased," the coroner said.
"My client is already in police custody, and it is his right to refuse."
"All right, all right," the coroner said.
Max sat down. "Stay in your seat. It's all right," Max whispered to Bigger. Bigger relaxed and felt his heart pounding. He longed for something to happen, so that the white faces would stop staring at him. Finally, the faces turned away. The coroner strode to the table and lifted the kidnap note with a slow, long, delicate, and deliberate gesture.
"Gentlemen," he said, facing the six men in the rows of chairs, "you have heard the testimony of the witnesses. I think, however, that you should have the opportunity to examine the evidence gathered by the police department."
The coroner gave the kidnap note to one of the jurors, who read it, and passed it on to the others.
All of the jurors examined the purse, the blood-stained knife, the blackened hatchet blade, the communist pamphlets, the rum bottle, the trunk, and the signed confession.
Owing to the peculiar nature of this crime, and owing to the fact that the deceased's body was all but destroyed, I deem it imperative that you examine one additional piece of evidence. It will help shed light upon the actual manner of the death of the deceased, the coroner said. He turned and nodded in the direction of two white-coated attendants who stood at the rear door. The room was quiet. Bigger wondered how much longer it would last. He felt that he could not stand much more. Now and then the room blurred, and a slight giddiness came over him. But his muscles would flex taut, and it would pass. The hum of voices grew suddenly loud, and the coroner rapped for order. Then a commotion broke out. Bigger heard a man's voice saying, "Move aside, please." He looked and saw the two white-coated attendants pushing an oblong, sheet-covered table through the crowd and down the aisle.
"What's this?" Bigger wondered. He felt Max's hand come onto his shoulder.
"Take it easy, Bigger. This'll soon be over."
"What are they doing?" Bigger asked in a tense whisper. For a long moment, Max did not answer. Then he said uncertainly,
"I don't know."
The oblong table was pushed to the front of the room. The coroner spoke in a deep, slow voice that was charged with passionate meaning.
"As deputy coroner, I have decided, in the interests of justice, to offer in evidence the raped and mutilated body of one Bessie Mears, and the testimony of police officers and doctors relating to the cause and manner of her death."
The coroner's voice was drowned out. The room was in an uproar. For 2 minutes, the police had to pound their clubs against the walls to restore quiet. Bigger sat still as stone as Max rushed past him and stopped a few feet from the sheet-covered table.
"Mr. Coroner," Max said, "this is outrageous. Your indecent exhibition of that girl's dead body serves no purpose but that of an incitement to mob violence. It will enable the jury to determine the exact manner of the death of Mary Dalton, who was slain by the man who slew Bessie Mears," the coroner said in a scream that was compounded of rage and vindictiveness.
"The confession of Bigger Thomas covers all the evidence necessary for this jury," Max said. "You are criminally appealing to mob emotion."
"That's for the grand jury to determine," the coroner said. "And you cannot interrupt these proceedings any longer. If you persist in this attitude, you'll be removed from this room. I have the legal right to determine what evidence is necessary."
Slowly, Max turned and walked back to his seat, his lips a thin line, his face white, his head down.
This ends Disc 11. Native Son, Disc 12.
Bigger was crushed, helpless. His lips dropped wide apart. He felt frozen, numb. He had completely forgotten Bessie during the inquest of Mary. He understood what was being done. To offer the dead body of Bessie as evidence and proof that he had murdered Mary would make him appear a monster. It would stir up more hate against him. Bessie's death had not been mentioned during the inquest, and all of the white faces in the room were utterly surprised. It was not because he had thought any the less of Bessie that he had forgotten her, but Mary's death had caused him the most fear. Not her death in itself, but what it meant to him as a Negro. They were bringing Bessie's body in now to make the white men and women feel that nothing short of a quick blotting out of his life would make the city safe again. They were using his having killed Bessie to kill him for his having killed Mary, to cast him in a light that would sanction any action taken to destroy him. Though he had killed a black girl and a white girl, he knew that it would be for the death of the white girl that he would be punished. The black girl was merely evidence. And under it all, he knew that the white people did not really care about Bessie's being killed. White people never searched for Negroes who killed other Negroes. He had even heard it said
that white people felt it was good when one Negro killed another. It meant that they had one Negro less to contend with. Crime for a Negro was only when he harmed whites, took white lives, or injured white property. As time passed, he could not help looking and listening to what was going on in the room. His eyes rested wistfully on the still oblong white-draped form under the sheet on the table, and he felt a deeper sympathy for Bessie than at any time when she was alive. He knew that Bessie, too, though dead, though killed by him, would resent her dead body being used in this way. Anger quickened in him, an old feeling that Bessie had often described to him when she had come from long hours of hot toil in the white folks' kitchens, a feeling of being forever commanded by others so much that thinking and feeling for oneself was impossible. Not only had he lived where they told him to live, not only had he done what they told him to do, not only had he done these things until he had killed to be quit of them, but even after obeying, after killing, they still ruled him. He was their property, heart and soul, body and blood. What they did claimed every atom of him, sleeping and waking. It colored life and dictated the terms of death. The coroner rapped for order, then rose and stepped to the table, and with one sweep of his arm flung the sheet back from Bessie's body. The sight, bloody and black, made Bigger flinch involuntarily and lift his hands to his eyes, and at the same instant he saw blinding flashes of the silver bulbs flicking through the air. His eyes looked with painful effort to the back of the room, for he felt that if he saw Bessie again, he would rise from his chair and sweep his arm in an attempt to blot out this room and the people in it. Every nerve of his body helped him to stare without seeing, and to sit amid the noise without hearing. A pain came to the front of his head, right above the eyes. As the slow minutes dragged, his body was drenched in cold sweat. His blood throbbed in his ears. His lips were parched and dry. He wanted to wet them with his tongue, but could not. The tense effort to keep out of his consciousness the terrible sight of Bessie and the drone of the voices would not allow him to move a single muscle. He sat still, surrounded by an invisible cast of concrete. Then he could hold out no longer. He bent forward and buried his face in his hands. He heard a faraway voice speaking from a great height. "The jury will retire to the next room." Bigger lifted his head and saw the six men rise and file out through a rear door. The sheet had been pulled over Bessie's body, and he could not see her. The voices in the room grew loud, and the coroner rapped for order. The six men filed slowly back to their chairs. One of them gave the coroner a slip of paper. The coroner rose, lifted his hand for silence, and read a long string of words that Bigger could not understand, but he caught phrases. "The said Mary Dalton came to her death in the bedroom of her home, located at 4605 Drexel Boulevard, from suffocation and strangulation due to external violence. Said violence received when the deceased was choked by the hands of one Bigger Thomas during the course of criminal rape. We, the jury, believe that the said occurrence was murder, and recommend that the said Bigger Thomas be held to the grand jury on a charge of murder until released by due process of law." The voice droned on, but Bigger did not listen. This meant that he was going to jail to stay there until tried and executed. Finally, the coroner's voice stopped. The room was full of noise. Bigger heard men and women walking past him. He looked about like a man waking from a deep sleep. Max had hold of his arm. "Bigger?" He turned his head slightly. "I'll see you tonight. They're taking you to the Cook County Jail. I'll come there and talk things over with you. We'll see what can be done. Meanwhile, take it easy. As soon as you can, lie down and get some sleep. Hear?" Max left him. He saw two policemen wheeling Bessie's body back through the door. The two policemen who sat to either side of him
took his arms and locked his wrists to theirs. Two more policemen stood in front of him, and two more stood in back.
Come on, boy.
Two policemen walked ahead, making a path for him in the dense crowd. As he passed white men and women, they were silent. But as soon as he was some few feet away, he heard their voices rise. They took him out of the front door into the hall. He thought that they were going to take him back upstairs, and he made a motion to go in the direction of the elevator, but they jerked him back roughly.
This way!
They led him out of the front door of the building to the street. Yellow sunshine splashed the sidewalks and buildings. A huge throng of people covered the pavement. The wind blew hard. Out of the shrill pitch of shouts and screams, he caught a few distinct words.
Turn him loose! Give him what he gave that girl! Let us take care of him! Burn that black ape!
A narrow aisle was cleared for him across the width of the pavement to a waiting car. As far as he could see, there were blue-coated white men with bright silver stars shining on their chests. They wedged him tightly into the back seat of the car, between the two policemen to whom he was handcuffed. The motor throbbed. Ahead he saw a car swing out from the curb and roll with screaming siren down the street through the sunshine. Another followed it. Then four more. At last, the car in which he sat fell in line behind them. Back of him, he heard other cars pulling out from the curb, with throbbing motors and shrieking sirens. He looked at the passing buildings out of the side window, but could not recognize any familiar landmarks. To each side of him were peering white faces with open mouths. Soon, however, he knew that he was heading southward. The sirens screamed so loud that he seemed to be riding a wave of sound. The car swerved onto State Street. At 35th Street, the neighborhood became familiar. At 37th Street, he knew that two blocks to his left was his home. What were his mother and brother and sister doing now? And where were Jack and G.H. and Gus? The rubber tires sang over the flat asphalt. There was a policeman at every corner, waving the cars on. Where were they taking him? Maybe they were going to keep him in jail on the south side. Maybe they were taking him to the Hyde Park police station. They reached 47th Street and rolled eastward toward Cottage Grove Avenue. They came to Drexel Boulevard and swung north again. He stiffened and leaned forward. Mr. Dalton lived on this street. What were they going to do with him? The car slowed and stopped directly in front of the Dalton gate. What were they bringing him here for? He looked at the big brick house, drenched in sunshine, still, quiet. He looked into the faces of the two policemen who sat to either side of him. They were staring silently ahead. Upon the sidewalks, to the front and rear of him, were long lines of policemen with drawn guns. White faces filled the apartment windows all round him. People were pouring out of doors, running toward the Dalton home. A policeman with a golden star upon his chest came to the door of the car, opened it, glanced at him briefly, then turned to the driver.
Okay, boys, take him out.
They led him to the curb. Already, a solidly packed crowd stood all over the sidewalks, the streets, on lawns, and behind the lines of the policemen. He heard a white boy yell,
"There's the nigger that killed Miss Mary!"
They led him through the gate, down the walk, up the steps. He stood a second, facing the front door of the Dalton home, the same door before which he had stood so humbly with his cap in his hand a little less than a week ago. The door opened, and he was led down the hall to the rear stairs and up to the second floor, to the door of Mary's room. It seemed that he could not breathe. What did they bring him here for? His body was once more wet with sweat. How long could he stand this without collapsing again? They led him into the room. It was crowded with armed policemen and newspapermen ready with their bulbs. He looked round. The room was just as he had seen it that night. There was the bed upon which he had smothered Mary. The clock with the glowing dial stood on the small dresser. The same curtains were at the windows, and the shades were still far up as they had been that night, when he had stood near them, and had seen Mrs. Dalton in flowing white grope her way slowly into the dark blue room with her hands lifted before her. He felt the eyes of the men upon him, and his body stiffened, flushing hot with shame and anger. The man with the golden star in his chest came to him, and spoke in a soft, low tone. "Now, Bigger, be a good boy. Just relax and take it easy. We want you to take your time, and show us just what happened that night, see? And don't mind the boys taking pictures. Just go through the motions you went through that night." Bigger glared. His whole body tightened, and he felt that he was going to rise another foot in height. "Come on," the man said. "Nobody's going to hurt you. Don't be afraid." Outrage burned in Bigger. "Come on. Show us what you did." He stood without moving. The man caught his arm and tried to lead him to the bed. He jerked back violently, his muscles flexed taut. A hot band of fire encircled his throat. His teeth clamped so hard that he could not have spoken had he tried. He backed against a wall, his eyes lowered in a baleful glare. "What's the matter, boy?" Bigger's lips pulled back, showing his white teeth. Then he blinked his eyes. The flashlights went off, and he knew in the instant of their flashing that they had taken his picture, showing him with his back against a wall, his teeth bared in a snarl. "Scared, boy? You weren't scared that night you were in here with that girl, were you?" Bigger wanted to take enough air into his lungs to scream. "Yes, I was scared." But who would believe him? He would go to his death without ever trying to tell men like these what he had felt that night. When the man spoke again, his tone had changed. "Come on now, boy. We've treated you pretty nice. But we can get tough if we have to, see? It's up to you. Get over there by that bed and show us how you raped and murdered that girl." "I didn't rape her," Bigger said through stiff lips. "Aw, come on. What you got to lose now? Show us what you did." "I don't want to." "You have to." "I don't have to." "Well, we'll make you." "You can't make me do nothing but die." And as he said it, he wished that they would shoot him so that he could be free of them forever. Another white man with a golden star upon his chest walked over.
"Drop it. We got our case."
"You think we ought to?"
"Sure. What's the use?"
"Okay, boys. Take him back to the car." They clamped the steel handcuffs on his wrists and led him down the hall. Even before the front door was opened, he heard the faint roar of voices. As far as he could see through the glass panels, up and down the street, were white people standing in the cold wind and sunshine. They took him through the door, and the roar grew louder. As soon as he was visible, the roar reached a deafening pitch and continued to rise each second. Surrounded by policemen, he was half-dragged and half-lifted along the narrow lane of people, through the gate, toward the waiting car.
"You black ape! Shoot the bastard!"
He felt hot spittle splashing against his face. Somebody tried to leap at him, but was caught by the policemen and held back. As he stumbled along, a high, bright object caught his eyes. He looked up. Atop a building across the street, above the heads of the people, loomed a flaming cross. At once he knew that it had something to do with him. But why should they burn a cross? As he gazed at it, he remembered the sweating face of the black preacher in his cell that morning, talking intensely and solemnly of Jesus, of there being a cross for him, a cross for everyone, and of how the lowly Jesus had carried the cross, paving the way, showing how to die, how to love and live the life eternal. But he had never seen a cross burning like that one upon the roof. Were white people wanting him to love Jesus too? He heard the wind whipping the flames. No, that was not right. They ought not burn a cross. He stood in front of the car, waiting for them to push him in, his eyes wide with astonishment, his impulses deadlocked, trying to remember something.
He's looking at it. He sees it.
The eyes and faces about him were not at all the way the black preachers had been when he had prayed about Jesus and his love, about his dying upon the cross. The cross the preacher had told him about was bloody, not flaming, meek, not militant. It had made him feel awe and wonder, not fear and panic. It had made him want to kneel and cry, but this cross made him want to curse and kill. Then he became conscious of the cross that the preacher had hung round his throat. He felt it nestling against the skin of his chest, an image of the same cross that blazed in front of his eyes, high upon the roof against the cold blue sky, its darting tongues of fire lashed to a hissing fury by the icy wind.
Burn him! Kill him!
It gripped him. That cross was not the cross of Christ, but the cross of the Ku Klux Klan. He had a cross of salvation round his throat, and they were burning one to tell him that they hated him. No, he did not want that. Had the preacher trapped him? He felt betrayed. He wanted to tear the cross from his throat and throw it away. They lifted him into the waiting car, and he sat between two policemen, still looking fearfully at the fiery cross. The sirens screamed, and the cars rolled slowly through the crowded streets, and he was feeling the cross that touched his chest, like a knife pointed at his heart. His fingers ached to rip it off. It was an evil and black charm, which would surely bring him death now. The cars screamed up State Street, then westward on 26th Street, one behind the other. People paused on the sidewalks to look. 10 minutes later, they stopped in front of a huge white building. He was led up steps, down hallways, and then halted in front of a cell door. He was pushed inside. The handcuffs were unlocked, and the door clanged shut. The men lingered, looking at him curiously. With bated breath, he tore his shirt open, not caring who saw him. He gripped the cross and snatched it from his throat. He threw it away, cursing a curse that was almost a scream.
I don't want it.
The men gasped and looked at him, amazed. Don't throw that away, boy. That's your cross.
I can die without a cross.
Only God can help you now, boy. You'd better get your soul right.
I ain't got no soul.
One of the men picked up the cross and brought it back.
Here, boy, keep this. This is God's cross.
I don't care.
I'll leave him alone, one of the men said.
They left, dropping the cross just inside the cell door. He picked it up and threw it away again. He leaned weakly against the bars, spent. What were they trying to do to him? He lifted his head, hearing footsteps. He saw a white man coming toward him, then a black man. He straightened and stiffened. It was the old preacher who had prayed over him that morning. The white man began to unlock the door.
I don't want you,
Bigger shouted.
Son,
the preacher admonished.
I don't want you.
What's the matter, son?
Take your Jesus and go.
But, son, you don't know what you're saying. Let me pray for you. Pray for yourself.
The white guard caught the preacher by the arm, and pointing to the cross on the floor, said,
Look, Reverend, he threw his cross away.
The preacher looked and said, "Son, don't spit in God's face."
"I'll spit in your face if you don't leave me alone," Bigger said.
"The Reds have been talking to him," the guard said, piously touching his fingers to his forehead, his chest, his left shoulder, and then his right, making the sign of the cross.
"That's a goddamn lie," Bigger shouted.
His body seemed a flaming cross as words boiled hysterically out of him.
"I told you I don't want you. If you come in here, I'll kill you. Leave me alone."
Quietly, the old black preacher stopped and picked up the cross. The guard inserted the key in the lock and the door swung in. Bigger ran to it and caught the steel bars in his hands and swept the door forward, slamming it shut. It smashed the old black preacher squarely in the face, sending him reeling backwards upon the concrete. The echo of steel crashing against steel resounded throughout the long, quiet corridor, wave upon wave, dying somewhere far away.
"You'd better leave him alone now," the guard said. "He seems pretty wild."
The preacher rose slowly and gathered his hat, Bible, and the cross from the floor. He stood for a moment, with his hand nursing his bruised face.
"Well, son, I'll leave you to your God," he sighed, dropping the cross back inside the cell.
The preacher walked away. The guard followed. Bigger was alone. His emotions were so intense that he really saw and heard nothing. Finally, his hot and taut body relaxed. He saw the cross, snatched it up, and held it for a long moment in fingers of steel. Then he flung it again through the bars of the cell. It hit the wall beyond with a lonely clatter. Never again did he want to feel anything like hope. That was what was wrong. He had let the preacher talk to him until somewhere in him he had begun to feel that maybe something could happen. Well, something had happened. The cross the preacher had hung round his throat had been burned in front of his eyes. When his hysteria had passed, he got up from the floor. Through blurred eyes, he saw men peering at him from the bars of other cells. He heard a low murmur of voices, and in the same instant his consciousness recorded without bitterness, like a man stepping out of his house to go to work and noticing that the sun is shining, the fact that even here in the Cook County Jail, Negro and white were segregated into different cell blocks. He lay on the cot with closed eyes, and the darkness soothed him some. Occasionally, his muscles twitched from the hard storm of passion that had swept him. A small, hard core in him resolved never again to trust anybody or anything, not even Jan or Max. They were all right, maybe. But whatever he thought or did from now on would have to come from him and him alone, or not at all. He wanted no more crosses that might turn to fire while still on his chest. His inflamed senses cooled slowly. He opened his eyes. He heard a soft tapping on a nearby wall. Then a sharp whisper.
"Say, you, new guy."
He sat up, wondering what they wanted.
"Ain't you the guy they got for that Dalton job?"
His hands clenched. He lay down again. He did not want to talk to them. They were not his kind. He felt that they were not here for crimes such as his. He did not want to talk to the whites because they were white, and he did not want to talk to the Negroes because he felt ashamed. His own kind would be too curious about him. He lay a long while, empty of mind, and then he heard the steel door open. He looked and saw a white man with a tray of food. He sat up, and the man brought the tray to the cot and placed it beside him.
"Your lawyer sent this kid. You got a good lawyer," the man said.
Say, can I see a paper? Bigger asked. Well now, the man said, scratching his head.
Oh, what the hell? Yeah, sure. Here, take mine. I'm through with it. Say, your lawyer's bringing some clothes for you. He told me to tell you.
Bigger did not hear him. He ignored the tray of food and opened out the paper. He paused, waiting to hear the door shut. When it clanged, he bent forward to read, then paused again, wondering about the man who had just left, amazed at how friendly he had acted. For a fleeting moment, while the man had been in his cell, he had not felt apprehensive, cornered. The man had acted straight, matter of fact. It was something he could not understand. He lifted the paper close and read, Negro killer signs confessions for two murders. Shrinks at inquest when confronted with body of slain girl. Arraigned tomorrow. Reds take charge of killer's defense. Not guilty plea likely. His eyes ran over the paper, looking for some clue that would tell him something of his fate. Slayer will undoubtedly pay supreme penalty for his crimes. There is no doubt of his guilt. What is doubtful is how many other crimes he has committed. Killer attacked at inquest. Then, expressing opinions about communists defending the Negro rapist and killer, Mr. David A. Buckley, state's attorney, said, What else can you expect from a gang like that? I'm in favor of cleaning them out lock, stock, and barrel. I'm of the conviction that if you got to the bottom of red activity in this country, you'd find the root of many an unsolved crime. When questioned as to what effect the Thomas trial would have upon the forthcoming April elections, in which he is a candidate to succeed himself, Mr. Buckley took his pink carnation from the lapel of his morning coat and waved the reporters away with a laugh. A long scream sounded, and Bigger dropped the paper, jumped to his feet, and ran to the barred door to see what was happening. Down the corridor, he saw six white men struggling with a brown-skinned Negro. They dragged him over the floor by his feet and stopped directly in front of Bigger's cell. As the door swung in, Bigger backed to his cot, his mouth open in astonishment. The man was turning and twisting in the white men's hands, trying desperately to free himself.
"Turn me loose! Turn me loose!"
the man screamed over and over. The men lifted him and threw him inside, locked the door, and left. The man lay on the floor for a moment, then scrambled to his feet and ran to the door.
"Give me my papers!" he screamed.
Bigger saw that the man's eyes were blood red. The corners of his lips were white with foam. Sweat glistened on his brown face. He clutched the bars with such frenzy that when he yelled, his entire body vibrated. He seemed so agonized that Bigger wondered why the men did not give him his belongings. Emotionally, Bigger sided with the man.
"You can't get away with it!"
the man yelled. Bigger went to him and placed a hand on his shoulder. "Say, what they got of yours?" he asked. The man ignored him, shouting,
"I'll report you to the president, you hear? Bring me my papers, or let me out of here, you white bastards! You want to destroy all my evidence. You can't cover up your crimes. I'll publish them to the whole world. I know why you're putting me in jail. The professor told you to, but he's not going to get away with it."
Bigger watched, fascinated, fearful. He had the sensation that the man was too emotionally wrought up over whatever it was that he had lost. Yet the man's emotions seemed real. They affected him, compelling sympathy.
"Come back here!" the man screamed. "Bring me my papers, or I'll tell the president and have you dismissed from office."
What papers did they have of his, Bigger wondered. Who was the president the man yelled about? And who was the professor? Over the man's screams, Bigger heard a voice calling from another cell.
"Say, you, new guy!"
Bigger avoided the frenzied man
and went to the door.
"He's balmy,"
a white man said.
"Make him take him out of your cell. He'll kill you.
He went off his nut from studying too much at the university. He was writing a book on how colored people live, and he says somebody stole all the facts he's found. He says he's got to the bottom of why colored folks are treated bad, and he's going to tell the president and have things change, see? He's nuts! He swears that his university professor had him locked up. The cops picked him up this morning in his underwear. He was in the lobby of the post office building, waiting to speak to the president."
Bigger ran from the door to the cot. All of his fear of death, all his hate and shame vanished in face of his dread of this insane man turning suddenly upon him. The man still clutched the bars, screaming. He was about Bigger's size. Bigger had the queer feeling that his own exhaustion formed a hairline upon which his feelings were poised, and that the man's driving frenzy would suck him into its hot whirlpool. He lay on the cot and wrapped his arms about his head, torn with a nameless anxiety, hearing the man's screams in spite of his need to escape them.
"You're afraid of me," the man shouted. "That's why you put me in here. But I'll tell the president anyhow. I tell him you make us live in such crowded conditions on the South Side that one out of every 10 of us is insane. I tell him that you dump all the stale food into the Black Belt and sell them for more than you can get anywhere else. I tell him you tax us, but you won't build hospitals. I tell him the schools are so crowded that they breed perverts. I tell him you hire us last and fire us first. I'll tell the president and the League of Nations."
The men in other cells began to holler.
"Pipe down, you nut. Take him away. Throw him out. The hell with you."
"You can't scare me," the man yelled. "I know you. They put you in here to watch me."
The men set up a clamor, but soon a group of men dressed in white came running in with a stretcher. They unlocked the cell and grabbed the yelling man, laced him in a straitjacket, flung him onto the stretcher, and carted him away. Bigger sat up and stared before him, hopelessly. He heard voices calling from cell to cell.
"Say, what they got of his?"
"Nothing. He's nuts."
Finally, things quieted. For the first time since his capture, Bigger felt that he wanted someone near him, something physical to cling to. He was glad when he heard the lock in his door click. He sat up. A guard loomed over him.
"Come on, boy. Your lawyer's here."
He was handcuffed and led down the hall to a small room where Max stood. He was freed of the steel links on his wrists and pushed inside. He heard the door shut behind him.
"Sit down, Bigger. Say, how do you feel?"
Bigger sat down on the edge of the chair and did not answer. The room was small. A single yellow electric globe dropped from the ceiling. There was one barred window. All about them was profound silence. Max sat opposite Bigger, and Bigger's eyes met his and fell. Bigger felt that he was sitting and holding his life helplessly in his hands, waiting for Max to tell him what to do with it, and it made him hate himself. An organic wish to cease to be, to stop living, seized him. Either he was too weak, or the world was too strong. He did not know which. Over and over, he had tried to create a world to live in, and over, he had failed. Now, once again, he was waiting for someone to tell him something. Once more, he was poised on the verge of action and commitment. Was he letting himself in for more hate and fear? What could Max do for him now? Even if Max tried hard and honestly, were there not thousands of white hands to stop Max? Why not tell him to go home? His lips trembled to speak, to tell Max to leave, but no words came.
He felt that even in speaking in that way, he would be indicating how hopeless he felt, thereby disrobing his soul to more shame.
"I brought some clothes for you," Max said. "When they give them to you in the morning, put them on. You want to look your best when you come up for arraignment."
Bigger was silent. He glanced at Max again, and then away.
"What's on your mind, Bigger?"
"Nothing," he mumbled.
"Now listen, Bigger. I want you to tell me about yourself."
"Mr. Max, it ain't no use in you doing nothing," Bigger blurted.
Max eyed him sharply.
"Do you really feel that way, Bigger?" "There ain't no way else to feel."
"I want to talk to you honestly, Bigger. I see no way out of this but a plea of guilty. We can ask for mercy, for life in prison."
"I'd rather die."
"Nonsense. You want to live?"
"For what?"
"Don't you want to fight this thing?"
"What can I do? They got me."
"You don't want to die that way, Bigger."
"It don't matter which way I die," he said, but his voice choked.
"Listen, Bigger, you're facing a sea of hate now. That's no different from what you've faced all your life. And because it's that way, you've got to fight. If they can wipe you out, they can wipe out others, too."
"Yeah," Bigger mumbled, resting his hands upon his knees and staring at the black floor. "But I can't win."
"First of all, Bigger, do you trust me?"
Bigger grew angry. "You can't help me, Mr. Max," he said, looking straight into Max's eyes.
"But do you trust me, Bigger?"
Max asked again.
Bigger looked away. He felt that Max was making it very difficult for him to tell him to leave.
"I don't know, Mr. Max."
"Bigger, I know my face is white," Max said. "And I know that almost every white face you've met in your life had it in for you. Even when that white face didn't know it. Every white man considers it his duty to make a black man keep his distance. He doesn't know why most of the time, but he acts that way. It's the way things are, Bigger. But I want you to know that you can trust me."
"It ain't no use, Mr. Max."
"You want me to handle your case?"
"You can't help me none. They got me."
Bigger knew that Max was trying to make him feel that he accepted the way he looked at things. And it made him as self-conscious as when Jan had taken his hand and shaken it that night in the car. It made him live again, in that hard and sharp consciousness of his color, and feel the shame and fear that went with it. And at the same time, it made him hate himself for feeling it. He trusted Max. Was Max not taking upon himself a thing that would make other whites hate him? But he doubted if Max could make him see things in a way that would enable him to go to his death. He doubted that God himself could give him a picture for that now. As he felt at present, they would have to drag him to the chair, as they had dragged him down the steps the night they captured him. He did not want his feelings tampered with. He feared that he might walk into another trap. If he expressed belief in Max, if he acted on that belief, would it not end just as all other commitments of faith had ended? He wanted to believe, but was afraid. He felt that he should have been able to meet Max halfway, but as always, when a white man talked to him, he was caught out in no man's land. He sat slumped in his chair with his head down, and he looked at Max only when Max's eyes were not watching him. "Here, take a cigarette, Bigger." Max lit Bigger's and then lit his own. They smoked a while. "Bigger, I'm your lawyer. I want to talk to you honestly. What you say is in strictest confidence." Bigger stared at Max. He felt sorry for the white man. He saw that Max was afraid that he would not talk at all, and he had no desire to hurt Max. Max leaned forward determinedly.
Well, tell him. Talk. Get it over with and let Max go. Or I don't care what I say or do now.
Oh, yes, you do, Max said quickly. In a fleeting second, an impulse to laugh rose up in Bigger and left. Max was anxious to help him, and he had to die.
Maybe I do care, Bigger drawled.
If you don't care about what you say or do, then why didn't you reenact that crime out of the Dalton home today?
I wouldn't do nothing for them.
Why?
They hate black folks, he said.
Why, Bigger?
I don't know, Mr. Max.
Bigger, don't you know they hate others too?
Who they hate?
They hate trade unions. They hate folks who try to organize. They hate Jan.
But they hate black folks more than they hate unions, Bigger said. They don't treat union folks like they do me.
Oh, yes, they do. You think that because your color makes it easier for them to point you out, segregate you, exploit you. But they do that to others, too. They hate me because I'm trying to help you. They're writing me letters, calling me a dirty Jew.
All I know is that they hate me, Bigger said grimly.
Bigger, the state's attorney gave me a copy of your confession. Now tell me, did you tell him the truth?
Yeah. There wasn't nothing else to do.
Now tell me this, Bigger. Why did you do it?
Bigger sighed, shrugged his shoulders, and sucked his lungs full of smoke.
I don't know, he said. Smoke eddied slowly from his nostrils. Did you plan it?
No.
Did anybody help you?
No.
Had you been thinking about doing something like that for a long time?
No.
How did it happen?
It just happened, Mr. Max.
Are you sorry?
What's the use of being sorry? That won't help me none.
You can't think of any reason why you did it. Bigger was staring straight before him, his eyes wide and shining. His talking to Max had evoked again in him that urge to talk, to tell, to try to make his feelings known. A wave of excitement flooded him. He felt that he ought to be able to reach out with his bare hands and carve from naked space the concrete, solid reasons why he had murdered. He felt them that strongly. If he could do that, he would relax. He would sit and wait until they told him to walk to the chair, and he would walk.
Mr. Max, I don't know. I was all mixed up. I was feeling so many things at once.
Did you rape her, Bigger?
No, Mr. Max, I didn't. But nobody'll believe me.
Had you planned to before Mrs. Dalton came into the room? Bigger shook his head and rubbed his hands nervously across his eyes. In a sense, he had forgotten Max was in the room. He was trying to feel the texture of his own feelings, trying to tell what they meant.
Oh, I don't know. I was feeling a little that way. Yeah, I reckon I was. I was drunk, and she was drunk, and I was feeling that way.
But did you rape her?
No. But everybody'll say I did. What's the use? I'm black. They say black men do that. So it don't matter if I did or if I didn't.
How long had you known her?
A few hours.
Did you like her?
Like her?
Bigger's voice boomed so suddenly from his throat that Max started. Bigger leaped to his feet. His eyes widened and his hands lifted midway to his face,
trembling. No, no, Bigger, Max said.
Like her? I hated her, so help me God, I hated her, he shouted.
Sit down, Bigger.
I hate her now, even though she's dead. God knows I hate her right now.
Max grabbed him and pushed him back into the chair. Don't get excited, Bigger. Here, take it easy. Bigger quieted, but his eyes roved the room. Finally, he lowered his head and knotted his fingers. His lips were slightly parted. You say you hated her?
Yeah, and I ain't sorry she's dead.
But what had she done to you? You say you had just met her.
I don't know. She didn't do nothing to me.
He paused and ran his hand nervously across his forehead.
Hell, I don't know. She asked me a lot of questions. She acted and talked in a way that made me hate her. She made me feel like a dog. I was so mad I wanted to cry.
His voice trailed off in a plaintive whimper. He licked his lips. He was caught in a net of vague, associative memory. He saw an image of his little sister, Vera, sitting on the edge of a chair, crying because he had shamed her by looking at her. He saw her rise and fling her shoe at him. He shook his head, confused.
Oh, Mr. Max, she wanted me to tell her how Negroes live. She got into the front seat of the car where I was.
But Bigger, you don't hate people for that. She was being kind to you.
Kind? Hell, she wasn't kind to me.
What do you mean? She accepted you as another human being.
Mr. Max, we're all split up. What you say is kind ain't kind at all. I didn't know nothing about that woman. All I knew was that they kill us for women like her. We live apart, and then she comes and acts like that to me.
Bigger, you should have tried to understand. She was acting toward you only as she knew how. Bigger glared about the small room, searching for an answer. He knew that his actions did not seem logical, and he gave up trying to explain them logically. He reverted to his feelings as a guide in answering Max.
Well, I acted toward her only as I know how. She was rich. She and her kind own the earth. She and her kind say black folks are dogs. They don't let you do nothing but what they want.
But Bigger, this woman was trying to help you.
She didn't act like it.
How should she have acted?
Oh, I don't know, Mr. Max. White folks and black folks are strangers. We don't know what each other is thinking. Maybe she was trying to be kind, but she didn't act like it. To me, she looked and acted like all other white folks.
But she's not to be blamed for that, Bigger.
She's the same color as the rest of them, he said defensively.
I don't understand, Bigger. You say you hated her, and yet you say you felt like having her when you were in the room, and she was drunk and you were drunk.
Yeah,
Bigger said, wagging his head and wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
Yeah, that's funny, ain't it?
He sucked at his cigarette.
Yeah, I reckon it was because I knew I oughtn't have wanted it. I reckon it was because they say we black men do that anyhow.
Mr. Max, you know what some white men say we black men do?
They say we rape white women when we got the clap. And they say we do that because we believe that if we rape white women, then we'll get rid of the clap. That's what some white men say. They believe that.
Jesus, Mr. Max. When folks say things like that about you, you whipped before you born. What's the use?
Yeah. I reckon I was feeling that way when I was in the room with her. They say we do things like that. They say it to kill us. They draw a line and say for you to stay on your side of the line. They don't care if there's no bread over on your side. They don't care if you die. And then they say things like that about you. And when you try to come from behind your line, they kill you. They feel they ought to kill you then. Everybody wants to kill you then. Yeah. I reckon I was feeling that way. And maybe the reason was because they say it. Maybe that was the reason.
You mean you wanted to defy them? You wanted to show them that you dared, that you didn't care?
I don't know, Mr. Max. But what I got to care about? I knew that sometime or other they was going to get me for something. I'm black. I don't have to do nothing for them to get me. The first white finger they pointed me, I'm a goner, see?
But Bigger, when Mrs. Dalton came into that room, why didn't you stop right there and tell her what was wrong? You wouldn't have been in all this trouble then.
Mr. Maxwell, help me God, I couldn't do nothing when I turned around and saw that woman coming to that bed. Honest to God, I didn't know what I was doing.
You mean you went blank?
No, no. I knew what I was doing all right, but I couldn't help it. That's what I mean. It was like another man stepped inside of my skin and started acting for me.
Bigger, tell me. Did you feel more attraction for Mary than for the women of your own race?
No. But they say that. It ain't true. I hated her then, and I hate her now.
But why did you kill Bessie?
To keep her from talking. Mr. Max, after killing that white woman, it wasn't hard to kill somebody else. I didn't have to think much about killing Bessie. I knew I had to kill her, and I did. I had to get away.
Did you hate Bessie?
No.
Did you love her?
No. I was just scared. I wasn't in love with Bessie. She was just my girl. I don't reckon I was ever in love with nobody. I killed Bessie to save myself. You have to have a girl, so I had Bessie. And I killed her.
Bigger, tell me, when did you start hating Mary?
I hated her as soon as she spoke to me. As soon as I saw her. I reckon I hated her before I saw her.
But why?
I told you. What her kind ever let us do.
What exactly, Bigger, did you want to do?
Bigger sighed and sucked at his cigarette.
Nothing, I reckon. Nothing. But I reckon I wanted to do what other people do.
And because you couldn't, you hated her.
Again, Bigger felt that his actions were not logical. And again he fell back upon his feelings for a guide in answering Max's questions.
Mr. Max, a guy gets tired of being told what he can and can't do. You get a little job here and a little job there. You shine shoes, sweep streets, anything. You don't make enough to live on. You don't know when you're going to get fired. Pretty soon, you get so you can't hope for nothing. You just keep moving all the time, doing what other folks say. You ain't a man no more. You just work day in and day out so the world can roll on and other people can live. You know, Mr. Max, I always think of white folks.
He paused. Max leaned forward and touched him.
Go on, Bigger.